Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 7. Now, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Xkuempikulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Xkrepik people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we're delighted to welcome to the studio Jean-François Chaumont, who is the owner with his wife Suzanne of Sacred Earth Eco Farm in Salmon Arm. Sacred Earth Eco Farm is part of the movement to bring back practices for growing food that have ancient roots and that have also roots in our relationship with the earth. Jean-François and Suzanne, along with other young and inspired farmers, are leading us back to a secure and resilient food supply. So a very warm welcome, Jean-François, to Food Conversations.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for the invitation.
It's great to have you here. And our conversation beforehand covered pretty much the whole universe, which is the way it should be. So let's plunge right in and talk about a mentor, somebody who is a really important person in your development as a farmer. And that's Jean-Martin Fortier. Jean-Martin was a pioneer in what's called bio-intensive agriculture that's influencing not just farmers here, but farmers all over the country and, in fact, farmers around the world. So why don't you tell listeners a little bit of how you came across Jean-Martin? How did you find that he was in the universe?
Well, once I decided I wanted to start a farm, I had to do a ton of research. It's not like...
You don't just plunge in. You have to think about it first.
No, yeah. It's not something that's presented in high school or it's presented as one of the best career moves.
But don't you think it should be, really?
Well, yeah, I do. Yeah. I think, I don't know. I do think that there's a lot of things that we're kind of putting on the side that are really important. And I think we're putting them on the side because they've just always been there. They do their job. They function well. So people tend to forget about them. And that's fine. But we do really need to remember them once in a while. Like, you know, who's growing the food? Who's transporting it? And, you know, how is this whole system working every time you turn on the lights? You know, there's a whole bunch of people working behind there to make that available for everyone.
So Jean-Martin is one of those people. He's cut a real profile. Why don't you describe, I mean, you must have been struck by him when you first came across his work.
Yeah, I think JM is at the forefront of the movement. I think he's leading it, to be honest. I mean, there's a lot of people since then that have taking their own, they're leading their own charge as well, mm-hmm. you know? And I've seen that across all countries around the world, you know, a ton in Canada, quite a bit in the United States, but also New Zealand, Australia, a lot of in Europe. France is rediscovering their market gardening quite a bit. I mean, they've continued the history of it, but it was... Right. You know, dying down, and now it's coming right back. New businesses are building around all the tools and right. implements that are needed for this new type of farming.
How did you didn't meet him in person? Where would you first come across his work?
Well, I bought a book.
Well, that's all right.
Jem wrote a book, and so I bought that, and I read the book cover to cover, and I listened to podcasts. He had YouTube videos. Wherever you get information from, that it's from books to podcasts to YouTube videos to, yeah.
Yeah, and that raised an interesting point because you can learn an awful lot about the world. I mean, there's websites that are full of nonsense, but a good website featuring a good person can really take something really important into your life and put it right there, right in front of you.
Yeah, there's so much information out there. It's so easy to have access to it. You just have to want to to read about it or to learn about it. So, yeah, I think it wouldn't have been possible to learn all this information if people weren't sharing either.
Now, Jean Martin, I don't know him as well as you do, so I call him Jean Martin, and you can call him JM. he's a Quebec, originally a Quebecois farmer, and it's interesting. He went to McGill, and he actually met his wife there, he started with his academic sort of approach, but he soon became enmeshed in new ideas, which are really old ideas. The notion of intensive farming is a very old idea. What, when you read about his stuff, what was it that stood out for you? How did it speak to you?
Modern farming is hard to get into, right? It's capital intensive. Barns, tractors, land, all the infrastructure is incredible. For a young person that starting from scratch, it's just, I don't know if it's possible. You'd have to have an inheritance or something like that, mm-hmm. or be grandfathered in somehow, or somebody kind of helping you along in a big way. JM's way of doing things, what he's figured out from picking up information across many places, mm-hmm. is that... This is a way for everyone to get into farming, because it's low capital investments, and then you can start getting returns right away, mm-hmm. and then you just kind of build and build and build on that progressively, and all these tools and ways of doing things are very simple.
His farm is named after a special tool that the organic firm is. Why do you describe that?
Because like Grelinette.
Yeah. Describe the tool, because it's sort of, the English term is a little more explicit.
Broad fork.
Yeah, it's a broad fork, but it really isn't a broad fork. It's a special tool with kind of a square handle.
Yeah.
And what does it do, this tool?
Well, the purpose of it is... for example, if I'm going to be planting carrots or any sort of roots, especially if they go deep, I'm going to loosen the substrate of the soil. So deeper in the soil, you just want to add a bit of space. So water, air, and just microbiology can go a little bit deeper. And it keeps the soil relatively looser as well for the roots. You don't have to do it for lettuce and, surface crops like that, but things are like carrots. It's beneficial for
that. They need a little help along the way.
Yeah.
the whole notion of biointensive, I of course, did a little research and looked up the concept. And one of the people who was commenting about it, a scientist in India, said... he really said this approach can solve the problem of hunger and poverty and nutrition and food insecurity, and as well as the livelihoods of farmers. It really kind of covers a lot of terrain, if you like. Maybe you could describe some of what you see as the basic principles in this approach.
Well, first of all, because it's easy access to people. Because the like I said, the starting capital is very low, mm-hmm. and you can build on it, do it part-time and all that. So it's accessible to a lot of people. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. It's biointensive. So you can plant 2 to 4 crops in the same space per year, mm-hmm. if you have the right crops and you do it at the right timing, right? Mm-hmm. So you can grow a lot of food in a small space. So you don't need hundreds of acres. You need more like, an acre, 5 acres, 10 acres, mm-hmm. and produce thousands of pounds of food.
And because you don't have big tractors and combines and this sort of stuff, you can put the rows of crops closer together. Literally, it physically can be more compact.
Yeah, the system is based on a 30-inch bed, and you can have whatever length you want, but you got to keep the lengths the same. Mm-hmm. So then if you buy insect netting, you can make sure that All of your insecticide will work on all your beds. Same mm-hmm. with your greenhouse plastic and anything else that you're using.
Yeah. And there are things like recycling nutrients. These are some of the features I mentioned. Using growing plants that sort of work together, or companion planting, that kind of thing. Regeneration and conservation of resources and of the soil. Soil is really, it's a central feature in biointensive agriculture, as I read it. And of course, everything is done organically, biologique, as they say in Quebec. Very much using natural remedies for pest invasions and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Our farm is certified organic. You could do it not certified organic as well. It's personal choice. But if you read the literature, the research, you find out that a permanent bed that isn't disrupted too much has mm-hmm. time to cultivate a multitude of biology inside of it, from microbes to the mycelium in the ground, and the connection between all of these, all this different life under there, is that it makes nutrition readily available for whatever it is you want to plant on top. Yeah. So you keep feeding the life in the soil, and they take care of your plants. So it is backwards from just thinking you're taking care of your plants. Yeah. Take care of the soil, and then, they'll take care of your plants.
I'm going to remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Jean-François Chaumont, who is the owner with his wife Suzanne of Sacred Earth Eco Farm. And just to give a little bit of an indication of how Jean-Martin Fortier is recognized around the world, on your website, I saw you had mention of the fact that on March 25th, he had received the Governor General's Medal for Meritorious Service, which is, there's not a lot of them handed out, and it's at only age 46. Obviously, he's highly recognized for his extensive work. And just translating it off your website, he said, he gives a bit of the history. He said, last Thursday has been a really important time for me, for I had the honor of receiving the Medal of Meritorious Service from the Office of the Governor General. The announcement came to me in November of 2020, telling me that this recognition was coming. And when he got that, he was very profoundly moved by it happening. In October of 2022, so he had lots of time to get ready this psychologically, he's sharing with you this happy news, thanks to receiving the official documents. And then today, which was March the 25th of this year, to hold this medal in my hands was just a surreal experience. The ceremony at Rideau Hall, which recognized my contribution as a pioneer, an international pioneer in biological or organic agriculture and small-scale farming, has been an experience that for me was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, obviously he's a humble person, but obviously also his achievements have been really quite dramatically important, and for you as well.
Yeah, he's generally a very humble person. Since I have watched videos from years and years ago when he was just starting, and he just wanted to help everybody. He wanted to tell the whole world what he's found out. felt it was important enough to spread this information as far as it can reach, right? And he's done a good job.
I was mentioning the beginning that some of the techniques that you're promoting are very old techniques. And in the history of biointensive agriculture, it points out that these approaches were used in the agriculture of the ancient Chinese, Greeks, Mayans, and in the early modern period in Europe as well, and in West Africa. They're sort of global. Everybody discovered the same thing because they were working with the forces of nature, and that shapes what you do, of course. Now, You had some farm exposure when you were a kid. You were your father's family had a farm.
Yeah.
What was that farm like for you as a kid?
Oh, it's amazing. Everybody says it's great to be raised on a farm, and it's true.
They're right.
I don't know what else to say. It's awesome. All my dad's family, they all own farms on the countryside in Quebec, in Saint-Anne des Plaines, the Chaumont. And Chaumont.
Family name on the countryside, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Dad told me at one point a couple years back, they own about 40% of the land mass in that town.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So just a lot of generations is passing things down and farming there. And I always wanted to hang out with my cousins. It's great. There's dogs and animals everywhere. Yeah. And it just right in nature and just... Every time we went to the farm, we had time to play and we, quads and other things like that and play fight and the hay and the hay and all that. But we also worked a lot,
For sure.
They would call me and be like, oh, we need an extra driver. We need to harvest this corn right away. It's dry right now. Yeah. So let's go.
And you used to climb trees.
Yeah.
You told me that. I had this image of you up in a tree just... surveying the domain, breathing the air and hearing the birds. And
I always had a strong connection to nature. I'm always fascinated at how closely tied we are to each other as humans, but also to our environment. I think we all feed from each other, right? So
absolutely. Now, one of the things you said struck me. It's something I want our listeners to understand because it's such an important thing. You said, exact words you said, I had a really hard time sitting down and listening to the teacher.
Oh, my.
But then you also said, and this is something that should happen more often, a physician was involved. And instead of saying, give this kid, Ritalin because he's, so active, he said, more activity. And you got into sports and, outdoors things like kayaking and hiking, stuff like that. But also you got into martial arts. And it became, what a productive way to take all that energy as opposed to, drugging it down in some way. And too often, and I'm a physician, a family physician, too often we pathologize behavior. Instead of saying, how do we accommodate this? We try and bring it down to a common denominator, which is not right. And this turn of events for you was extremely important. It gave you an opportunity to learn all sorts of things about how your body worked and, interacting with other people and discipline, all that kind of stuff. Describe how that getting into the world of physical exertion and of course, specific martial arts, how that affected you over the years, that beginning?
Well, I was really grateful to have that doctor for sure, because now that I'm older and a little bit wiser, I realized that it was very important for that decision to be made on my behalf when I couldn't make it.
Yes, yeah.
But instead of suppressing parts of who I was and the way I function, decided to use that, right? And I think that's probably a much better, a much healthier way of dealing with some problems is to just find a place to put yourself into where that's a win. And it's not a place where you, get your wrist slapped for
falling behind or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
No. And, I think the reason I wanted to bring this out is because I think it's such an important thing for us all to be thinking. And my colleagues in the health professions, if you're listening, I hope you're paying attention to this because it's such an important principle. Different qualities in different people are not deficits and advantages. They're all gifts of some sort. And we're starting to understand that more and more. And it was just... I was touched by the fact that this, you escaped the potential, you know, drugging down experience, which is unfortunately far too often the case that happens. So also around there, you said you were sort of thinking about what you wanted to do, even quite early in life when you're 8 to 10, these thoughts crossed your mind of wanting to do something that you cared about.
Well, with the martial arts, I did the same monkeying around that I did in classrooms, and I just didn't listen, and I try to make everybody laugh, and I didn't take anything seriously. Mm. And I had some good coaches or you know, masters, I guess you would say, in martial arts. And one day it was just I don't know, it was like another day, but I was just heading my head was getting banged against all the walls, right? The teacher wasn't happy with me, and even the students were tired of laughing, and it was kind of time for me to decide what I was going to do here. You know, am I going to stay here and screw around and waste time and waste other people's time, or am I going to take it seriously? And I remember sitting in the back room where everybody gets changed, and sitting there and having a good reasoning. And I decided that I was going to fight from that point on. And I was going to stop taking the easy road. Mm. I had to start taking the hard road, because that's where, you know, all the people I admired the most were at. And they all took the hard road, and they all did the hard work, and they all ended up where I wanted to end up. So I just got back into class, and I did all the push-ups that I was avoiding, and I did all the setups, and then I did some on top of it just to show the teacher that this was a new turning point.
So it was quite a moment in your life. It was like, doing a sharp turn. And how did that affect things for you?
Well, over the years, I developed my love for nature, and with the lessons I learned from martial arts and you know, my parents and everybody else that surrounds, you know, kids when they're growing up, I think I started to understand you have to do the difficult things. Mm-hmm. If you don't do the difficult things, you don't get the rewards that come with them. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So, you know, you want comfort, then you're going to end up with the leftovers.
You began working early at lots of different jobs. You worked on the farm, of course. That was the obvious place to start work. You couldn't avoid it anyway, because they say, drive this truck.
Yeah.
But as time went by, you started to do lots of different kinds of jobs. At around age 17... then you got involved in a program called Kitimovik. How did that come about? Because it's a very interesting program.
Yeah, I had two plans. Find a job that I liked, a career that I liked. And I also had enough time to think about what I wanted for relationship. And I wanted to have a family. So those are the two things I had clear in my mind. And I was a bit scared coming out of school, because it's just in the adult world and just not knowing where to go and how it works and all that. I decided to just go to Kitimovik because it would offer me an opportunity to learn a lot. I felt like I didn't have enough information to make decisions of any sort. Right. So I wanted to be informed and maybe a little bit get some inspiration of where to go next. So yeah, I did Kitimovik, 9 months, 3 different provinces, learned English. And on my last province was BC, right here in Salmon Arm. Yeah, I was
What were you doing in Salmon Arm?
SPCA.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and my wife was working there at the time. So yes. That's where we met. And
you met over a little puddle of cat urine or something like that.
She dealt with cats and I dealt with dogs. And we cross paths every so often. Yeah.
Were you already thinking of where you might go in your career at that time? Or was it things were still shaping inside you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it about? I mean, obviously, Suzanne is, I mean, I've looked at your Facebook site and she's very much a part of what you're doing. And she's not, you know, off in the corner, you know, some other place with the kids. She's right there. Yeah. And your kids are as well. Yeah. They're very involved. Was that something that you knew was going to be that she was a participant, not just, you know, staying in her own place?
As everybody that's been in relationship for a long time, you know that compromise is the key to success. And
thank you.
My wife is great, so she saw how passionate I was and how determined I was to start this farm and start this new project, and she jumped in to support me and. We build this together. Mm-hmm. There's no me or her. It's us.
Yeah.
It is like that. Every time you've got a tight knit family, mm-hmm. The work gets done together. Mm-hmm. You know.
Of course it does. Of course it does. I remind listeners once again, I'm talking with Jean-François Chaumont, who is the owner with his wife Suzanne, who is very much a participant of Sacred Earth Eco Farm. It's interesting, the word Ktimovik is Inuktitut for meeting place.
That's right.
And I suspect you weren't the only person who met somebody in your travels, a person's travels that you connected with and really started a relationship that obviously continued long after that. After this, at some point, you came out to BC. I think it was 2008. You came to this province.
Yeah.
What brought you back here? I mean, apart from Suzanne, which obviously was a big influence.
Yeah. Yeah. We decided to start a family in Salmon Arm.
Mm. And she was raised after a certain point in her life. She was raised in Salmon Arm. She wasn't born.
Yeah. Her family moved here. I think she was 8 years old from Vancouver. Mm. Not downtown Vancouver, in the outskirts.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was it about BC? I mean, for both of you, obviously.
Obviously, is my wife.
Yes.
She was worth it. And I was, at the time, I had no plans for careers. But like I said, one of the two things that I knew I wanted was, figure out what type of career I would end up doing, right? And also family.
And one of the things you did was you had career advisory tests you could do online. That's a very interesting thing because there used to be tests like that offered by, say, the YMCA, but it's not offered anymore. But there are online ways. And you used some of those. And what sort of messages were they giving you?
They were giving signals on the top list. It was all jobs related to engineering, business management of some type, and farming.
Hmm.
And I dismissed the farming every single time because I saw how much equipment, how much land is needed to do that. It just didn't seem possible. So I just discarded it. And then I looked into engineering because I like solving problems. And so I looked into that and contacted a couple engineering firms here in town and met with a few and asked them some questions, got to figure out what the job was like and all that. And kind of decided that it was a bit too much computer work. I like being hands-on, and I like using my head as well, but mm-hmm. it's got to be balanced. I don't like too much of one or the other. Mm. So it was too much sitting down.
And in the background, there was all maybe this sense of the natural world sort of being part of what you really liked.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it didn't touch all the chords. You know, there was an appeal for it for me for sure, but it didn't touch everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you described at this point in your life doing a lot of research, like exploring lots of things while you were working. And in fact, you said, I was doing 40 hours of day job and 30 hours of study as I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. That's a pretty heavy commitment. That's a lot of time spent trying to get answers for yourself.
Well, I was doing well at my job, quite well, and I reached a point where there wasn't a lot more to learn, and I felt, I thought, am I going to do this for another 5 years, 10 years? Is this going to be my career, right? Am I going to spend, the rest of my working life in that industry? Hmm. And I started thinking that no, no. I liked the job and I liked it. There was a lot of good things about it, but I wasn't passionate about it. You know, I wanted something that didn't feel like work all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I started to just, I was obsessed at one point. I just started to research all the different careers. I did all the tests. And then I followed through, contacted people, looked at the amount of schooling that each one of them would require. And when I ended up finding a small farm here in Kelowna, that at the time was doing urban farming. Mm-hmm. And kind of inspired me to kind of look into it a lot deeper. And then I ended up finding JM's book, mm-hmm. read all of that, and JM's videos, and all related podcasts.
Did you ever meet him?
I never got a chance to meet him personally.
Isn't it interesting that you could sort of know the essence of somebody's work so well and use a lot of the things he suggests? The book that he wrote, of course, is very practical and down to earth and tells you lots of things to actually do with the land. But you never actually meet the person, but it becomes what he's teaching and showing and explicating becomes very much part of your life without ever actually talking to him. Well, maybe you talk to him. Do you ever talk to him?
No, I haven't.
Well, we're going to have to tell him that you're out here doing this work. So you were obsessed. You were working 40, 70 hours a week, nearly half of which was trying to get a grasp. And then what happened? Land.
Yeah. Just working, coming home, and then I would do 2 or 3 hours of research, sometimes 5 hours after work. The weekends were half days, usually of work, just researching everything. Mm. I ended up finding young agrarians, landed on them. And at the time, Tessa was the person that was the land matcher.
Tessa Weatherall, I think she's got a different last name. She married and has a
name. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's taking care of other things right now. I don't think she's land matching anymore.
Yeah. What was that like? What did she bring for you to help you on your way?
Well, she showed me all the contacts that they have made up to this point. And we talked about what I was looking for land. And then she contacted some of the landowners that she thought might be a good match. And then I met a couple of them. And I ended up falling on the current landowner that I have right now. Mm-hmm. And we got along very well. We were on the same page on a lot of different things. I found out years later that his dad used to have a big garden and used to sell the overabundance of produce that he was producing in the garden to the downtown ISQs at the time. So his dad did pretty much what I am doing right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he had also a big love for nature and a connection to the land, and he wanted the land to be used in holistic way, a good way, you know?
Yeah.
And he lives on the island. So this is the land he grew up in. And so, yeah, he just wanted it in good hands and something good to be done with it. And
so you had a meeting of the minds, as they say. You were on the same wavelength.
It was a land matching, but yeah. I think it was more of a pupil matching.
Yeah. Well, Tessa once said to me that it's kind of like being a marriage counselor.
Yeah.
You know, you try to find out if the two people involved are, you know, compatible. And when they're compatible, then the process of addressing the land and what you do to it just falls into place from that relationship. And that's sort of what you found.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very important. Community futures also played a role in there.
Yeah. I took a loan to start the farm, mm-hmm. and that was at Community Futures. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were amazing. Everybody there was amazing. They helped me get the loan. It wasn't too complicated, and they've always been supportive. Plenty of resources that I need for starting a business or expanding or anything like that. So, yeah, no, it's been a good relationship.
And the other sort of community within a community that you came across and got attached to was the Shuswap Food Action Society, although at the time it was called the Shuswap Food Action Co-op.
Yeah.
And we talked about that before the show, and we both agreed that the word co-op was a really good word.
Yeah, I agree.
And John McLeod, whose his family farm has been here for, you know, practically as long as the community. What was your connect with John? I have a soft spot for John. He's left us now. He died a little while ago, but what was that like for you meeting him?
It was great. I think starting a farm and I was I was relatively new compared to someone that's been born and raised here. And I also didn't have a ton of connections, if any at all, to the farming community at the time. And John was just, it reminded me of home, right? He's just an old farmer, and his demeanor was very much like the farmers and the family members that I grew up with. So it felt very, I felt very comfortable talking to him, and he was very down to earth and gave me just tons of advice, and just a good-hearted person and a common sense person too.
Mm, yes. Yeah. With a laugh that you could hear right across the room.
Yeah.
No, he was a lovely guy. He was on the local municipal government's environmental advisory committee for
really?
Quite some time, and I had a feeling I dropped in to see him as he was getting, you know, his health was failing. I'd go and see him at his home, and we'd have coffee and cookies that his wife Lois had baked, and I went to see him a day before he died. And I just had this feeling I had to go and visit John, and we had a lovely conversation, which he was having some difficulty with, and he was very near the end of his life. And I think everybody who was involved with farming this community, and certainly with the Shuswap Food Action Co-op, which he was a major force in founding, appreciates his influence, because it was a very benign leadership. You know, he wasn't a heavy-handed leader. He was standing by you, not, you know, telling you what to do. So you took the plunge. You took the plunge, and you started to create the farm. Why don't we go through the words that you used to describe it? Because each one seems to me has some special significance. Like sacred, you used the word sacred.
Yeah.
And tell listeners why that was something important for you.
Well, it meant a lot for me. It felt like I was, I don't know, it was growing inside of me, right? Mm. This idea, this newfound passion, I felt like I was going in the right direction. Mm. Even all of the problems that were coming up, they were all good problems because every problem taught me something else that then led to more success, then more problems and more success. And I feel like the connection we have with the earth in general is sacred. Mm. We are very dependent from each other as humans, as much as we disagree with a lot of different things. But we're really dependent on each other. We're also very dependent on our food source, which comes from the earth.
Absolutely. Which is the second word in the title. You mentioned the earth. What is that? What significance does that have?
Well, sacred earth. The earth is sacred. We get food from there. We get we also get a lot of resources that allow for all this technology and all the comfort and all the things that we enjoy today. So, you know, I'm very grateful that we that we have it. So try, as far as the food is concerned, really try to keep the biodiversity and the life in the soil and make it as healthy and as long-lasting as possible.
Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Jean-François Chaumont, who is the owner, with his wife Suzanne, of Sacred Earth Eco Farm. And the farm's not just a farm, it's an eco-farm.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I wanted to be part of the environment, not you know, fighting against it. So that was the ideology I had starting into that, and I still do. So that's why we're certified organic. We want to be organic, certified or not. I wanted to make sure that the way I farmed was just something you can farm for hundreds or thousands of years onto, right?
And your kids can play in the farm without you having to say, oh, don't go near there because we put some chemicals out that might do you some harm.
That's right.
And they do. Your Facebook site is filled with photographs of your kids sticking sticking labels on the, your son sticking a label on the package of greens that has been prepared. It says, I remember something like, are we ready to go now? Okay. And he sticks the label on fast as he can. The bio-intensive principles that are underlying it as well play an important role in the way you've laid the farm out, the way you've laid out. Describe that a little bit, because it's quite thoughtful. It's quite a thoughtful way of doing it.
Yeah, and I can't take much credit for that. Other people have figured that out. I just figured out it was a good idea for myself.
We pray to your statue. Yeah.
And people before him. I mean, a lot of roots go to the old French farmers and other places on
a lot of old farmers all over the world.
Yeah, it's just we're using the old ideas and you putting new technology into it from today.
One thing that's interesting about Quebec is that Quebec takes the idea of organic more seriously than almost all other provinces. BC and Quebec have been known for a long time to be the leading province when it comes to healthy farming. And in fact, one of the things I learned a long time ago was that the same rules apply to declaring something organic as applied to wine varietals. Like you can't call something that's Merlot Pinot Noir. Yep. And if you do and it isn't, then you can be fined.
Yeah.
And you can be fined for saying something's organic when it actually isn't. That's in a way, if I came from the only province in Canada that had done this and actually taken this seriously, I think I would be kind of proud to know that I was a proud Quebecer.
yeah. I don't know. I'm very proud to be Canadian, and Quebec is definitely has a special place in my heart. Yeah. BC is another beautiful place in Canada. Mm. From all the provinces, they have their thing. But for me, if I had to choose a place to live, it would be one of the two.
Mm. You know? Do you go back home to Quebec for visits?
I did last year.
Yes.
I had to bring my son to Quebec to meet his family and for him to get a taste of the culture there. It's very rich. It's very deep. Yeah. And I just wanted him to see, his heritage.
And what did he think of the Chaumont family's takeover of the town?
I don't think he cared. He's too young. He cared to meet his grandma and all the food. He's so impressed by the food and the houses are different. The people are different.
Yeah.
So he was really it really piqued his curiosity, and he wants to keep visiting there on a more regular base if he can muster the money for it.
Well, it's nice to have two cultures in your life. Yeah. You know, it's so much enriching. So on the farm, you grow specific kinds of things. Why don't you just give a bit of a rundown of what you're growing on your farm?
For years, we did salad mix because we grew a couple of different things on our first year. And salad mix is what other people weren't growing. It's one of the hardest thing to grow. You have to grow multiple different types of lettuce. You have to grow multiple different types of other leaves, like spinach and arugula and patsoy or kale or whatever it is you can figure out, baby leaves, right? So it's very intensive. It's a lot of work. It's all going to be washed. It's going to be dried, packaged, and all this. There's a lot of handling involved in it.
If anybody wants to see that, they can go to your Facebook site, because you've got several videos there showing the work that's involved.
Yeah, I wanted the customers to have, like, I want to, the whole point is I want anybody to go and walk on the farm at any time. Invited. I don't want to have people in there.
4 o'clock in the morning. We just thought you said come over.
But anybody could come and they can walk wherever they want. They can touch whatever they want. They can eat whatever they want where it stands, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem. It's perfectly natural and normal.
So has that evolved now to, is that basically what it is, the baby greens especially, is that sort of the focus that you have now?
Yeah, it has been the focus, because I strongly believer that you have to pick something and own that craft before you can expand onto other things. I think especially us guys are very focus-minded, doing multiple different things at the same time. It gets complicated really fast. I just wanted to have one thing that I could focus on, so then I can learn the problems of this one crop, of this one product, and I could get better and better and better over the years. And I had so much to learn, right? I didn't know much about the soil. I did not know much about the land, the type of environment that was there, like where the wind's coming, how much rain do I get here, how much does water collect. Do I have clay? Do I have sand, sandy loam? Does it vary? There were so many factors I had to learn. So
it's interesting for a kid who had trouble sitting and listening to the teacher. You, as an adult, are sort of a practical researcher at every step of the way, that you explore the reasons why, the factors that influence what's going on. I think it's You're a model for all the kids who in the world who didn't find sitting in a classroom in straight rows, listening to lectures, to learn that success is right in front of you by your own efforts, just by exploring and reading and watching videos and reading books by Jean-Martin Fortier, stuff like that. You grow your crops, and I'm sure you must do a lot of succession planting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Because it's one thing I'm kind of keen on, but I probably should know more about. But with greens, especially baby greens, you have to keep on doing waves of them.
Oh, my goodness. This is one of the things that was really complicated, is knowing when to plant things. And you could say, oh, I'll plant. Once you figure out how much you need... Farming is all about the future. Has the future and the present. Everything in between is doesn't matter. So I got to plan for the whole year in advance. That's the minimum.
Yes.
If not 5 years in advance, if I can, because you can make small steps every month or every year towards a longer goal, right?
Sure.
But when you plan farming your crop season, you go from the end of the year working your way all the way to the spring or the end of the winter.
Yes.
And it goes this way with absolutely everything you do. So your customer wants, let's say, 100 pounds of carrots every week. Then you need to go and make sure, okay, how many seeds is 100 pounds? How many seeds do I need to have 100 pounds? How many plants is that? And then you need to have a rate of failure. And so you increase that number. And then somebody else wants 15 pounds. The other person wants 500 or something like that, right? So you add all of these numbers and then you make sure that you have these available results every single week. So it got really complicated. And then in the spring too, the weather progressively gets warmer. So if you plant every week, what ends up happening, it's like putting things in a fridge that's really cold. And then you put more things in the fridge and then the temperature keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter. So eventually everything's going to spoil at the same time, even though you put things in there every week, because it's an exponential growth, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I had learned that you have to plant things every second week and you have to be disciplined and not plant too much, mm-hmm. because else everything will all be coming at the same time, and mm-hmm. the 100 pounds of carrots that you need per week, and now you have like 300.
Mm. Yeah, it's and you're having to adapt to the rhythm of Mother Nature when she changes the beat once in a while.
Yeah,
and that's happening a lot these days. You know, extreme weather events have become more prominent all the time, compared to what it used to be like when I've been here since 79, and the changes since then till now are really quite dramatic. How are you finding the changing climate and extreme weather events? How's that impinging on what you're doing? How's that affecting it?
Farming is, you're taking risk all the time. So I'm not as sensible to it, but I don't really care. you forget to do something, you forget to water something, and then you lose some production in your crop. Mm-hmm. You forget to fertilize something, well, you get less production. Mm-hmm. And let's just say you get a lot of cold weather in the spring, for example, and usually you don't. Well, now you got to adapt on the fly, so you got to have you gotta see the problems ahead of time and have solutions for them. And so, you know, if there's forest fires, which we've had here, it's affected the crops. Ironically enough, some crops had a hard time with it. I think the crops that needed more light, but then some crops absolutely loved it because there's more carbon in the air, and that's food.
So you plant variety. You plant a variety of. Then this is a typical for a small farm. You don't just have one crop. You have different plants. Some that can handle rain. Some that can handle drought. Some that can handle heat. Some that can handle cold. Which is in fact one of the reasons why small farms are so productive, is because you have this variety. You never get stuck without anything growing because there's some condition to which some plant is adapted. We're coming close to the end of the show, but I wanted to just mention one thing that's relevant to what you're doing, and that is the city of Salmon Arm has just declared that if you're growing food, you will have no water restrictions placed on you. And
I just saw that.
And I when I contacted the city about that, because I'd heard from everybody that they were really upset about the pipe having to restrict their water use on the plant. It's one of the best things that the city's done. It's exactly what's needed.
Yeah.
When you're growing food, there should be no impediment imposed by our society on the person growing food. We're actually coming to the end of the show, and I want to thank you. I want to thank you, Jean-François, very much for coming here, for just describing a very human story of coming to what is essentially a place that everybody growing food has got to come to, which is thinking about the earth and the planet when you grow, so that the food that we all need is available to all of us all the time. I want to thank you again very much for being here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Warren.